All right, we'll let the anxiety go down. So, Dr. Norman Blumenthal, really a pleasure. One of the world's experts in trauma, is director of the Trauma Services, the Zachner Family National Trauma Center for OL Children's Home and Family Services. And it's really a pleasure to have you and to welcome you back. And we look forward to hearing your talk. Okay, Bakasha, now you can share your screen and get
Okay,
started.
well, I'll first speak for a few minutes and then I'll share my screen. These are very hard acts to follow, and I'm very humbled by all of the presenters. Actually, I remember when I was growing up, the rabbi of my community used to begin his sermon with, "Before I speak, I want to say something." So before I speak, I also want to say something. First, I want to thank Rabbi Jay and Rebbetzin Ulana for organizing this. And it brings back fond memories of other times that I've presented. And you've really created a forum for which it's an honor to present in. I also want to acknowledge my friends, Michael and Marshall Lacks, and were such inspiration to me. As I often mention to them, they made the same mistake my in-laws made. They allowed their daughter to marry a Blumenthal. But it's really very special to see them and for all that they do. And I want to thank OHIL for giving me this opportunity. But mostly, I want to thank my co-op Debbie and my co-presenters. By the way, Debbie, I was wondering why I haven't been able to find my keys these last few years. Whenever you're ready, you can give them back to me, maybe. But actually, all your very generous comments
I'm
reminds
keeping
me
them. I'm not giving them back. No,
all
they're
right,
staying with me.
so my
Don't worry
door will
about
be
it.
unlocked. Yeah, it's okay. We've had about six robberies since then, but okay. Your comments remind me very much of the line of the great New York philosopher and theologian, Yogi Berra, who said, "I never said most of the things I said." So I don't know if that's true here as well, but it really is truly humbling. I mean, listening to all of you, I feel so inadequate. And I hope that what I can talk about today will be a contribution. I was asked to speak about what's often referred to as vicarious trauma or secondary trauma, and are we all in this together? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to define with a through PowerPoint what secondary trauma is, or vicarious trauma. And then I'm going to pose the question whether what we went through on this side of the Atlantic was secondary trauma or was it really primary trauma, but maybe not to the same extent. So it's just a question that I will pose, and I will talk about a very interesting sort of corollary to secondary trauma, which is secondary resilience, which very much speaks to what so many people have spoken about. So first, I'm going to share my screen. Hope I have a grandchild by in case I blow it, but okay, seems to be going pretty well so far. I also hope that we'll have some time for questions at the end. Okay, let me just turn this into a slideshow. There we go. And play from the start. Okay, so again, the focus is on vicarious trauma. Are we all in this together? And so let me first define secondary or vicarious trauma. This is my own definition. Secondary or vicarious trauma is the assault on the equanimity and perception of safety and predictability of the caretaker for a primary victim of tragedy. In other words, those of us who help people, like so many of the people who have spoken before, help the people who've been traumatized, or those who witness it remotely. In other words, those who read about the newspaper, see it on the internet, etc. The provider or viewer, in turn, experiences trauma. So, in other words, the interesting thing about vicarious trauma is that even though it's secondhand, you experience it nonetheless. You experience a trauma of your own, not to the same extent, but you do experience a trauma. Let me just give an example. This is lessons learned from Newton. Newton is a town where the school, the San Diego school, there was a school shooting. And this is an article appeared in 2017, even though the school shooting was in 2012. In the days following the 2012 school shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School, Newton, Connecticut, Police Chief Michael Kehoe would scream in his sleep, reliving the gruesome scene in his dreams. His relationship with his wife suffered because he ordered her around in an attempt to exert control, and he was racked with guilt. Studies show that 15% of police officers will develop post-traumatic stress disorder over the course of their careers, says John Violante, research professor of the School of Public Health, University of Buffalo. About one-third of the officers will develop some PTSD syndrome, symptoms, he said. So these are examples of those who are directly helping the person. This, by the way, not surprisingly, is actually a Rashi and Chumash, so with the Rishus of Rabbi Kelman and the other Rabbanim here, in the Shir it says Tipol Alehem Ematav Fachad, two different expressions for fear. So Rashi says Tipol Alehem Ematal Rechokim Pachad Alakrovim. Emata Fachad were the Egyptians themselves who were drowning. Emata were those who either witnessed it or read about it in the Moabite Times. Of course, my question on this, when I teach my rabbinical students at Yeshiva University, is I would then, it should really say, Tipolahim Pachad Ve'emata. The primary trauma is more severe. So this is the question I can leave hanging. If we have time, I'll give you my attempt to answer it. Now, there are two types. There's the immediate, which I alluded to, ambulance drivers, EMTs, police officers, firefighters, emergency room health providers. We heard from Ellie Beer. I mean, that was clearly an example of, let's assume for now, secondary trauma, those people who went running to help. And then there's the ancillary secondary trauma, which is trauma therapists, later health providers, investigators, media, clergy, or those who read or hear about it or watch it on video recording. So you can have much more immediate secondary trauma or more ancillary secondary trauma. So what are the symptoms of secondary trauma? So many of them actually resemble PTSD. And as Professor Brom, again, somebody I really love hearing all the time, alluded to, that most people do not develop PTSD. PTSD is rare, but you can have what was also sometimes referred to as post-traumatic reactions, which are intrusive thoughts, flashbacks, emotional ability, all that you've learned about already. So it resembles post-primary trauma, but more cumulative. Here's a very important point in terms of understanding secondary trauma. For primary trauma, the person who was in the vehicular accident, the person who was at the Nova concert, the person who was at the Kibbutz Berry, they obviously had a very incredible, very powerful traumatic reaction. For those who help, for those, let's say, like myself and members of my team, who go later and help out or who read about it or hear about it, it's each trauma is, each time we do that, we're traumatized, but it's a little trauma. It's not quite as severe, but it grows. It stays with us. So the classic call I will get, I guess the classic call I get is from one of these Hatzalah drivers who have, one of these heroic Hatzalah drivers in Yabek Mon B'Yisrael, who, you know, nothing gets them. Bullet wounds, severed limbs, whatever it might be, blood, nothing phases them. And then they'll get a fairly, what they call ordinary call, and they fall apart. And because what's happening is that each call chips away at their sense of safety. And it creeps up on you and catches you unaware. So even when we're here at this side of the ocean and we're reading articles and we're listening to the news, and or if you've done what I did, like go to Israel on one of these missions, and you hear about it, each time you're getting a modicum of trauma. And it just builds up. And then there's one more piece and it gets to you. So that's very difficult. And that's what's so scary about it. And so that's why, for example, on our trauma team, we insist that whenever somebody goes on a trauma intervention, they have to come and talk to one of us, either myself or one of the other administrators in the program, because, you know, I'll call them. I'll say, we want to come in and talk about it. We say, I'm fine. I'm fine. And they do feel fine. What they're not aware of is it's catching up with them. And it could, as I said, could blindside them. So we try to act an ounce of prevention. This, by the way, is very important in terms of following the news from Israel. Actually, somebody gave me a very good template for that. The Gemara in the Nedarim says that, ask when's the best time to visit someone who's sick. And they say in the middle 3 hours of the day. Because the Gemara says in the first 3 hours of the day, the person just had a night's sleep. He looks pretty good. And the last 3 hours of the day, he looks so sick that you've given up on him and you won't pray for him. But the middle of 3 hours of the day, he looks sick, but not so sick that you'll still be motivated to pray for him. And that's really what we have to adhere to in terms of, we've been following these news events. We have to really sort of filter it and make sure we do follow. So we're mobilized to help in any way we can, but not so saturated that it starts affecting our mood and our functioning. And that's been a challenge for me as well. There can be cynicism. You know, you sort of have this dangerous world belief, or just give up on anything good that there could be. And many people have been seeking out some of the inspiring stories, many of which we just heard now. There could be depersonalization after a while. In fact, that's actually my fear. People ask me, I've been doing trauma work now for about 35 years, which is pretty incredible because I'm only 37 years old. But the you know, at this point in my career, I'm more worried about becoming callous. I'm more worried that I've done so much that I will hear of a trauma and I won't be sufficiently affected. I tell my wife all the time, if I have to get called in for one of these horrific events and I have to drop everything and run, and I can go with no hesitation, it's time for me to retire. I have to hate it. I have to feel the enormity of what I'm going to. And by the way, what complicates it more is when you're doing these interventions, I often say, on my way there, I'm a wreck. When I leave, I'm a mess. But when I'm there, I'm thought out and calculated. So when you're in the throes of the situation as a helper, you have to sort of disconnect from your emotions because you won't be able to think straight. So you have this situation where but in the meantime, it is impacting you. So the impact catches up with you later. So again, that's the tricky thing about secondary trauma, that it's sort of, as I said, it blindsides you. That's interesting that some of the studies, we often talk in our field about empathy, that that's the ultimate goal. And the difference between sympathy and empathy is that sympathy means, yes, I know somebody else is suffering, but I can't imagine myself that person. Empathy is really nosa ba'ol. You really put yourself in that person's place so you can experience it as if that person's experiencing it. And the interesting thing is that the studies find that if you have empathy without the opportunity to do something, it can lead to a lot of depression and fatigue and demoralization. So it's very interesting that if you have an activity to do, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit later, if there is something you can do, then the empathy helps. If you're sitting here on this side of the Atlantic and reading about it and hearing about it and hurting, and you can't do anything, you're better off being sympathetic than being empathic. So there's a room for compassion. They did the difference between empathy and compassion. The difference between compassionate but not necessarily empathic if you are immobilized. So again, that speaks to how important, that while you're doing the assistance, or maybe even while you're reading, sometimes you have to kind of disconnect a little bit. So you understand and you feel bad, but you don't immerse yourself because, especially if you're then immobilized, then you can't do anything. So there is room for, as I said, sympathy as well as empathy. Here's just an example from an article. Okay, one second. Let me just get it. Here we go. Dr. John F. Raffensperger, emergency room pediatric surgeon in Chicago for the last 40 years, describes what happens psychologically when a patient is brought in following a shooting or stabbing. Blood everywhere, trying to stop it, trying to place the blood that has been lost. Will it help to split the sternum to get to the proximal artery? Is there enough time to save this child? After the surgery, the sadness catches up with you. And that's how secondary trauma works. Now, where does this come from? And so I'm going to create a scene for you. It really comes from a very positive thing, which is the need to bond or connect. So I'm going to create the following scene for you. When we make weddings or bar mitzvahs, at least here in New York, until fairly recently, we had to put together seating at the wedding, let's say. And anyone who's done it, it's a huge undertaking. In fact, I remember my father, Lava Shalom, when first time he made a wedding, he said next time he makes a wedding, he's going to do the seating and then send out the invitations. But it's enormous. Now they're starting to get lazy and they'll say, the family at this table, the friends at this table, the social misfits at this table. So, but before that, this was, you really actually got assigned, still used to occasionally get assigned a seat. So I remember when we made our weddings, we had what we called our Shaya Rukos table. These are the people that belong nowhere. It was that third cousin who you wouldn't have invited except they happen to live in your neighborhood. The psychiatrist who sends you referrals and you owe him a favor, but he really lives in a different town. The best friend you grew up with who now lives in Kiryat Arba and is coming in to be part of the wedding. So you put together this random table with different people. So suppose you're at a wedding and you get seated at this sort of random table and you're sitting next to someone, and you introduce yourself. Hi, I'm Noam Blumenthal. I'm so and so. Where are you from? Kiryat Arba. Now, what's going on in your head? In your head, you're thinking of everything or you know about Kiryat Arba. Oh, yes, I visited it once 10 years ago. Oh, yes, I have a third cousin who lives there. Or I remember reading about. Why do we do that? Because we are by nature social. We want to bond. We want to connect. So when someone tells you something about themselves, we go through our data bank and try to find the common denominator, Nitzara Shava Beneihem, what we have in common. So therefore, that's in a way what happens when we read about the atrocities, or hear about them, or see them, or when we are helping someone with those kind of, who've been through these kind of trauma, we in a way feel the trauma ourselves. We either access our own experiences, as Debbie described beautifully before many others did, or we try to imagine ourselves in that person's place. So we then get traumatized. So it's really based on a very human piece of ourselves, especially those of us in the helping profession, whether it's medicine or mental health or clergy. We self-select because we tend to be more inclined to do this kind of connecting. However, then in these situations, we get traumatized in turn. I mean, this is again, fathers in primitive cultures often have the symptoms of pregnancy when their wives are pregnant, sans baby. But again, it's that need to connect, that wish to connect. So it comes from a very kind of healthy place. And then there's another interesting topic, which could be a presentation of itself, which actually Naomi Baum from Israel has spoken a lot about, which is the shared traumatic reality. What happens when you're helping someone else and you're going through the same trauma? We had this very much during the COVID situation, and we have it now as well. We're all traumatized by what's happening. And when I have to either go to a school or a community or individuals who are reeling from the events that occurred these past few months, I'm reeling too. So it's not like I'm helping someone who had a trauma that I'm not going through. I'm in a way going through it as well. So, and certainly for those of you in Israel, so the more so. So it takes a lot of skill to make sure, on the one hand, you have a certain unique understanding if you share an experience. On the other hand, you have to make sure you don't blur the boundaries, that you're talking about it in terms of what's happening to the other person and you're not imposing your own experiences on the other person, which may be more unique to you. Or to quote, and do you share your own personal, as many information as Dr. Goldstein described earlier, how she shared her own personal information. And I'm often reminded of Harry Stack Sullivan, who's the founder of the American School of Psychiatry, who used to tell the residents he was training, when doing therapy, there should only be one anxious person in the room, preferably not the therapist. But it again, how much do you keep to yourself and how much do you share? My standard is, first of all, where I am in the connection with the patient, and I make sure I process it with myself, show that I'm sharing this for the patient, not because I need to get it off my chest. It may be beneficial secondarily to me, but I'm doing it for the sake of the person I'm trying to help. Here's a fascinating finding, which I think speaks again to what Debbie and many others spoke about before, which is police officers versus firefighters. And, the police part got blurred out. Okay, but it's police officers, firefighters. I once had a conversation with the head chaplain of New York City Police Department, and she told me, I mean, she didn't give me studies, but she told me that police officers have much more secondary trauma than firefighters. And you'd wonder why. They're both exposed to much of the same kind of trauma. So why would that be? And she explained it to me that in a typical police precinct, one squad car goes to this trauma. One squad car goes to this one. Another one goes to this one. In the fire department, they go together as a unit and they come back to the firehouse as a unit. So they have a kahilla. They have each other. And therefore, they have less secondary trauma. And again, it speaks to what we're trying to do here in terms of sharing this and living through it together as a community, which helps with the trauma. So then let me tell you a little bit. Everybody's been so personal, so I'm going to share my own. I want to talk to you about what I went through, and again, it's nowhere nearly what many other people did, but during October 7th, and lessons I've learned since then. So, of course, I was in Montreal. We were in Montreal visiting our children. And, of course, Shabbat, we heard the dreaded news. We were in a shul with a lot of shlichim from Israel, and many of their phones were ringing off the hook. They were trying to mobilize them. So we heard pretty quickly what was going on, and it was, of course, dreadful. We were just all just shocked beyond belief. And, of course, we keep 2 days, so Matzah Shabbat was still Chag, so I wasn't able to access any the internet or the phone, et cetera. And that night, I was wondering, will I be able to go to sleep? I was so distraught. And I did, but I had a very interesting dream. I had a dream that night that I was supposed to present a patient at a conference. And I was taking the patient with me to the conference to present him. And, you know, this wouldn't be, you know, we wouldn't do that. But again, a dream is, can, doesn't have to adhere to reality. And while we were driving midway, or in the middle of a forest, actually, this patient, and was a real patient in my practice, he told me he doesn't want to do it. And he made me stop the car and he got out of the car. So now I didn't have the patient to present. So I drove back to my office. I figured, let me pick up my notes about this patient. And of course, I walked in my office and all my patient's notes are strewn all over the desk. Again, this wouldn't happen today. Everything's on the computer, but I'm riffing through papers looking for this patient. I can't find his notes. Then I look up at the clock and I see that I'm supposed to present in an hour and the conference is an hour away. And I don't have my notes and I don't have the patient. And of course, I wake up and my heart is pounding, as you often do from an anxiety dream. And it takes a few seconds to realize that this wasn't reality. And I was up already. So I started thinking about it. And I realized that here, this terrible thing is happening. This terrible thing's happening to Israel, to my people. And I can't do anything. Again, it goes back to what I was talking about before with the compassion and the empathy. I felt so strongly about what was happening and I was powerless. So I think that's what the dream was reflecting. Sunday night, when I came home from shul, you know, first thing I did, of course, went to my phone. And of course, it confirmed and validated everything that I had heard, if not more. And again, I was just feeling that helplessness, and the enormous anxiety. And then the emails started coming in and the phone calls started coming in from OHEL, from trauma team. We got to do something. We got to put together advice to parents. And within no time, I was working on some suggestions for family, for parents, how to process this with children. And we set up a webinar for Monday night where I would speak to the community. We had driven up to Montreal, so we drove to another set of children in Muncie, so we wouldn't have to deal with trying to get into the city, for those of you who know New York geography. And I gave a webinar with Naomi Baum, the other Naomi Baum from Israel. There were some, and there were two things I said that in retrospect, reflected the lack of awareness of its impact. One of them very much related to what we're talking about. One, which I won't go into because it's not really our topic, but I advocated protecting our younger children, the preschool age children, giving them a sense of safety that this happened far away and try to insulate them from the enormity of the trauma. That was a waste. The preschool age children, in fact, I think they're the most vulnerable group. I was speaking to a group of high school faculty in Ramaz shortly afterwards, and I said to them, I wonder what your applicants are going to look like 9 years from now, because these are children who have so much trauma at a young age. But in terms of the second, I presented it as secondary trauma. After all, we weren't traumatized. We're hearing about it. We're reading about it. And this was before the upsurge of anti-Semitism that we've seen. And I slowly started realizing, talking to people in schools and shuls, that wasn't the case. The reaction of the people here really very much more resembled primary. It smelled more like primary trauma than secondary trauma. So it made me think, like, why? This is really technically secondary trauma. And I have three explanations, maybe fourth, if we factor in anti-Semitism. But one is, first of all, only 1 to 3 generations removed from the Holocaust. And again, right, Peres described aptly that how it was a deliberate attempt to reenact the Holocaust, and much of the anti-Semitic protests are referencing the Holocaust. So and this was, again, Jews singled out for all these atrocities. So I think it gave it more of an immediacy. The enormity of the atrocities, this was just, you know, again, if you have to take it in bite-sized portions because it is so traumatic. But even when I was there hearing from, you know, survivors, and there are no words for it. And then one more thing is, we have internet and we have social media, and it comes to you in a very graphic way, and it comes to you immediately. It's not like you're getting the news 24 hours later on newsprint. You're seeing it and you can witness it almost immediately, whatever's going on, and in very realistic sense. So I think this also made it more primary trauma. And then, of course, now, as time has gone on, the meteoric rise in anti-Semitic incidents, and then the viciousness of those who are advocating, you know, the pro-Palestinian protesters, has made it very much on our own very doorstep. So I'm starting to think now that maybe we, with regard at least October 7th, and maybe in general, we have to look at it not as primary trauma, secondary trauma, but different gradations of primary trauma. Because I think many of us here on in Galut, here in the United States and in Canada and all throughout the world have are really been primarily traumatized. Obviously, not to the extent that the Israelis have, but the and one more difference being that the Israelis have much more opportunity to take action to prevent it, or to even if you want to look at it as retaliating against it, whereas we're much more limited in how much we can do. And in that respect, it's probably even harder here. We can't grab a gun and go to the front. We can't, you know, so it makes it even a little bit more traumatic because where our hands are tied. And then again, try to end on a more positive note. And I think I'll have a few minutes for some questions. Accompanying, you know, sometimes people ask me how you know, I said I've been over 30 years, I'm doing trauma work and grief work. They've asked me, how can you do this? Why doesn't, you know, how can you do this kind of work? And one of the answers I give them is, I don't just see trauma. I see tremendous resilience. I see unity. I see incredible faith. You know, I've worked a lot with parents who've lost children, as was alluded to earlier, and I was once speaking to a group of parents who lost children, and I said, you know, all the years I've worked with hundreds of such parents, the number that went off the derech I can count and probably in the finger of one hand, and they were teetering on the brink even before the tragedy. And I remember afterwards, a Hasidic woman comes to me and says, "Why are you so surprised? Well, where else are we going to turn?" So I've seen incredible resilience, strength, and faith, and this has, in a way, balanced the tragedy and misfortune that I'm exposed to. So just an article, if you want, you can access it. It's in Family Process. You know, where they actually were in Colombia studying survivors of massacres and other kinds of, you know, horrible tragedies, and how that witnessing their strength and their resolve was ennobling for the people who were there to help. I'll just, you know, cite the quotation here. After working with people who suffer, have suffered these kinds of problems, your definition of a problem changes. What helped was that I always found a person or a group of people who showed balance in approaching their interactions in difficult situations. This helped me overcome my fears. I could trust them and I could learn how to handle these difficult situations. This work generates a positive change as you generally may become more resourceful, less fearful, more dynamic, more resolute, more active, and eager to question yourself permanently. When you witness someone with something like a kidnapping, you question why you don't cope better with your own losses. In other words, you develop your potential. And this has been so much about what people have spoken about, is that we're not only seeing such, you know, unprecedented, at least in our generation, atrocity, but we're seeing such unity and strength, et cetera. And we have to take that in as well. Those of you who know me, I can't resist without at least incorporating one cartoon. So the guy says, "The air I breathe is filthy. My food is poisoned. My automobile is a gas-guzzling behemoth. My school taxes have doubled. The Internal Revenue Service plans to take the fillings out of my teeth. My wife is 53 and pregnant. My dog bit a lawyer's kid. My son steals. My mother-in-law is a communist. My daughter ran off with a fink. And now you tell me if I don't back up and have the right of way, I'll be in trouble." Again, it's all about perspective. I think I have a few minutes, if I'm not mistaken, so I can take some any questions, rebuttals, or actually, let me just check the chat that there's something I need to hold on.
I don't think there are any questions in the chat, but if anybody wants to unmute themselves, send Vakasha. But thank you very much. Really fascinating presentation. All the presentations, I mean, it's really quite amazing. But any questions, comments? Oh, okay. Good cartoons. Okay. Yes. And,
Okay. All right. Thank you for the opportunity.
Let me just, one, since you have a couple minutes, you're asking,
Sure.
you know, for those of us who live here, how do you see it sort of, is it becoming less? You know, sort of time goes on, you know, people in Israel want to get back to quote unquote living as normal as possible. And, you know, that's a question here. And what do you think, you know, people making weddings and going out to party or the Super Bowl even, you know, we haven't mentioned that the Super Bowl hasn't come up today, but you know, it's like it's Super Bowl. Like, how can you even talk about it? At the same time, you want to be normal, you know, and the Super Bowl is like the biggest day in American sports. So I don't know if you want to maybe address that for a couple of minutes, how to navigate that.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, again, I'll quote my favorite person, Yogi Berra, who used to say that predicting is very difficult, especially about the future. It's hard to predict. But one of the things that I'm wondering about with the upsurge of anti-Semitism and the invalidation of what we know is true by somebody, so-called Ivy League professors and presidents and et cetera, that are we going to be getting more ghettoized? You know, we have, especially in the modern Northwest community, we have very freely mingled with and exchanged ideas with the broader community. Are we going to feel as welcome? I know that one of the conversations, I know I teach at Yeshiva University, one of the conversations at Yeshiva University, I'm not on any administrative position, so I'm not making decisions, but just informally among the students and some of the faculty is, are we going to be, a lot of people going to switch into places like Yeshiva or Bar-Ilan or Touro or, you know, or Hebrew University to feel safe? And is that a benefit? First of all, I don't know about other universities, Yeshiva is like filled up. I mean, there's no room. But also, what impact will it have on the university when people are going there only because they're scared to go to the school of their first choice? So I think that we're going to, I'm just wondering about that, how our status and how our, in fact, even the whole idea of Torah Mada, I'm finding that the current smicha students who I mostly teach are not as invested in that concept as we were when I went to Yeshiva University in the 70s, because the Mada side now just looks what's being, yeah, I'll get to your question in a minute, but the Mada side is now so, such lies, such distortions. So that's what I'm wondering about is, are we going to become more like, are we going to become more ghettoized? Yes, please, Ms. Gruber, Dr. Gruber, not sure. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you, Dr. Blumenthal. I don't know if you could hear me.
I don't.
Oh, okay. So firstly, I've heard you speak before. Very inspiring. In fact, I heard you speak in Staten Island after Superstorm Sandy, and I've read Man's Search for Meaning a few times. I do work at City University of New York in technology. In my case, I do feel safe for other reasons. Not that I'm in agreement with things that are occurring, but that's politics. And my question is this. So here, being, I guess a second source of trauma or second person of trauma. What type of therapy should a person seek out? It's not necessarily situational depression. It's not something where, you know, I can change the world, the changes. What type of therapy would be good for someone who is being affected by this and can't go out on the next mission trip for a month? What do you recommend?
You know, we do secondary trauma interventions. In fact, what I think one of the most riveting I ever did was, many of you may remember the Sassoon family fire in Midwood about, I think it's about 6 years ago now. And a colleague and I did a session for the Chevra Kadisha that had to prepare the bodies of those children who were burned. And then, of course, now in Israel, this was a huge trauma. And what happens in those sessions, and this has been also when I go to a Tzala garage or any of these kind of situations, is they, at first they downplay. We're okay, we're okay. Well, especially the Tzala guys, you know, and then they start talking and all the similar kinds of, in this case, all the similar types of taras that they did over all the years of children, of fire victims, all came cascading and flooding into their memory. So therefore, a lot of the work is to start putting, and again, that's so much a work of all trauma, is to put the what's sitting, and again, we're familiar with Basil van der Kolk's work, what's sitting in the brainstem, in the deep primitive part of our brain, and bring it out into words where it shifts to the frontal cortex, where we can look at it and we can deal with it. So it's really verbalizing and also taking self-care, taking care of ourselves. As I said, portioning out how much of this you're going to be exposed to. You know, you don't, you may not be ready. Listen, I was, when this happened, October 7th, I happened to be reading for recreational reading. I was reading a book called Palestine 1936, which is about the Arab uprising in what was in Palestine in 1936. And it was history, you know. Suddenly it wasn't history anymore. So much it was current. I couldn't read the book. I had to put it down. I later got back to it and finished up, but I couldn't read it. And we have to, you know, I often like to quote Shakespeare. Again, I'm reflecting my Torah Mada education, but in Othello, at the end of the play, as you know, Othello was this great Moorish general nearly occupied the world. And then at the end, he was betrayed by friends, and he, without unjustifiably, kills Desdemona, his wife, and he's about to thrust the sword in his chest. And he says, remember, he who loved not wisely, but too well. And that's a very important line. I mean, I think about that myself. We have to love, but we have to love wisely, not too well. And that's all part of the treatment. Most of the work that we've done on the OL trauma team has been more collective. I've gone to schools. I've gone to communities. You know, we've met with groups and larger groups and done sort of so we're doing here, psycho-ed with conversation. I hope that answered the question. I think I'm running out of time. Am I right?
Thank you. Thank you. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Thank
okay.
you.
My pleasure.
Amazing. We're on our ninth speaker. And we're only 1 minute behind schedule. So that's pretty, thank you very much
wow.
to all the speakers for staying
not
on.
Very, not very, not very,
I mean,
not
I
very
banged them on the head to tell them they have to stay on time, but still. But thank you very much. Really a pleasure. Thank you. And okay, we look forward to having you in the future. But thank you. And Ari Sittner, Rabbi Dr. Achron Achron Chavi, you want to say hello? We'll start in 30 seconds. People want to stand up, take a stretch before we start. Dr. Ari, say hello, please.
Thank you. A pleasure and honor to be here with you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. And an honor to meet you. We, unlike many of the other speakers, we have not met yet. So, thank you. Thank you for being here. Okay. I'll do a very brief introduction in half a minute or so. I hope your anxiety doesn't go up for that. So Dr.
Blumenthal. It just might. I'll tell Dr. Blumenthal to stick around for me.
Yes. Okay.